G'day, Chris. How are you today?
Very well. How's yourself?
Mate, going very well. Thanks so much for joining us. Now, you made a post on social media giving an insight into Luke Longley this week. And what kind of a response have you had to it, and what motivated you to do it?
The response has been incredible, and I think it just reaffirms the standing that Luke has in people's minds, that he's a legend of the sport and people are really keen to maybe know a little bit about him, especially around him not really featuring in the Last Dance documentary. But look, the only reason I wrote it was I've done a few, and through this time in isolation, I used to write a bit, and I thought instead of writing about some of the things that a lot of other people write about, I thought I would, I've been in a pretty lucky or fortunate situation to be around some pretty incredible people over my journey, and thought I'd write about not just the people, but probably the lessons they taught me along the way.
Yeah, Chris, what have you made of the Last Dance documentary?
It's been really interesting. I've loved watching it. I was a little bit different. I actually played for the Bulls the year after the Last Dance. I was there in 2000 and got to hear a little bit about it, speak with the staff and sort of walk those same corridors of that crew. So it was really fascinating back then. But to be reminded of that, and I suppose the biggest thing for me, and there are a lot of lessons we take from it, that even the greatest teams of all time still go through their challenges, and not everything's probably perfect. And finding a way to blend those different personalities, I think Phil Jackson's genius, and every one of those guys was certainly important.
Obviously, you weren't there when Jordan was there, but were there players there that had played with him? And what was the chat around Jordan? Was he a well-liked person? We know he was an absolute freak as a basketballer, but did you get the feeling that they liked him, or they just put up with him because he was a great player?
Yeah, there were still five or six guys that had played with him. And I think if you went around and asked some of the most successful teams, the word's always respect before like, and that's more important. And I think every one of those guys, whatever sort of conversations they had off the floor in a training, there was certainly that respect when they put on their uniforms together, and they all wanted the same thing. They all wanted to win, and they all wanted to get better, and they needed Jordan to be able to do that. And I think as we're learning through this documentary, he certainly needed them more and more as well. So it was still that, but when you're around the locker room, they don't really talk too much about it. What's going on, and he stuck his head in a few times. He heard one of the young guys had been talking a bit of trash about the kid was a great athlete and he'd be able to play him one-on-one, and so Jordan just turned up and sat his pants one day and proceeded to beat him real easy in front of the whole team just at the end of practice, and he still had it and he still got that swagger, and his presence loomed large over the Chicago Bulls for a long time. Probably still does if you walked in there today, I'd imagine.
Chris, how do you compare Jordan to LeBron? Again, different eras. The game's changed a lot. But is it fair to compare those two, in your opinion?
I think it's okay to compare anybody. I think we need to... I never like picking a best of the best, because I think we... Sometimes when we've got one of the best of all time playing in front of us, we forget to appreciate them, because we sometimes think they might not be the greatest of all time. But LeBron's a great. I think Jordan revolutionized the game. I think he's an incredible athlete who did things that other players just couldn't do. And if you look through the documentary, the type of physical defensive philosophies that were implemented against him were just brutal. And he was still able to lead the league in scoring and win championships year after year. But the really interesting part is, as well, we've actually seen how much better he's gotten over his career, because sometimes we only look at those 6 years and think how great he was. But it took him a while to get there, and he had to learn a lot and grow up a lot. I think the documentary's done a great job of recounting that.
Chris, one thing I just can't get my head around is you have the Bulls, executive manager there, Jerry Krause, the general manager, essentially wanting to tear apart arguably the greatest team in basketball history, even saying to Phil Jackson, I don't care if you go 82-0, you're not coaching this team next year, which I just cannot believe that that was the case. In a weird sort of way, this all benefited you to an extent in the fact, well, you ended up as part of the rebuild, sort of.
I can't really fathom that either. I think sometimes when you've got something so great and the best of all time, you have to ride it, even if it means the lows might be a little bit lower at the end. And they were anyway. I mean, he chose to rebuild straight away and we were really bad straight away. I think the team as it stood in its championship state certainly could have had another crack. And you know, they could have slowly retooled with youth down the end. But look, Jerry was an interesting one. But for me, he was actually the only, or the guy that represented the Bulls that came down to Australia to visit me before I got drafted. And going into the draft, all I knew was that if I was still available at the Bulls pick, that they were going to pick me on draft day. So, you know, that was exciting in itself. I ended up getting drafted a little bit earlier, which was also fantastic and unexpected. But for me, you know, my only dealings with Jerry Krause were really positive, but they were when he was recruiting me and probably wanted to say all the right things. So, it's been interesting watching that perspective.
Chris, what about the NBL? What can we be doing here in Australia to see this competition, I guess, and I mean this respectfully, but get back to where it used to be?
Yeah, I think it's been incredible the last few years. Crowds have been consistently up year after year, and I don't keep statistics on crowds, of course, but if you go back over the years, I think you'll find that the average crowd attendance last season was bigger than it ever was in what a lot of people our age consider the heyday of the sport. Mm. That's for a number of reasons. It's, you know, it's bigger stadiums, it's easier travel and that kind of thing. But the interesting part always for me was, you know, I happened to play for the Tigers and the Magic when, you know, in the mid-90s there, and the crosstown games were incredible and the Melbourne-Sydney rivalries were incredible, but there were still a lot of weeks where we'd play the Newcastle Falcons or the Townsville Suns at the tennis centre and only 2,000 people turned up. So it's funny how our, you know, history seems to remember and very, you know, pleasingly so, the 15,000 and the sold-outs, but there were still some quiet ones in the middle. I think what we've seen this year is a consistency of attendance, and people have grown to know the basketball players here in the NBL because they have been better marketed, and you know, different sporting codes, different media outlets know the teams and the players. It's been great.
Yeah, and it's certainly got a lot of traction with the Next Stars program with LaMelo Ball and RJ Hampton coming across from the States and plying their trade here in our competition, and they're expected to go high up in the draft. So is it a disappointment, though, that they've stopped that now and they've got this new G League Pathways program in place over there in the States?
Yeah, I don't think they've stopped it. I think it's just been paused for, you know, through this coronavirus. So, you know, it'll come again, and the reason that it couldn't this year, and you know, and I can't remember the young man's name who chose the G League, but yeah, you know, he couldn't travel. He can't get here, so that didn't become an option. So I think you'll find that the NBL is continuing to have conversations with some really talented players. And look, we've got one in this year. He just happens to be Australian, but Josh Giddey, who most NBL fans would know, is Warwick Giddey's son. He's an absolute talent. He signed for the Adelaide 36ers as part of that Next Stars program. But look, I think just even that a big part of that was what Joey Wright did years ago. And just having Andrew Bogut, I think, come back to the league and play for the Kings really rubber-stamped how genuine the NBL was. And I'm pretty sure we'll see some really talented kids come through that Next Star program in years to come, even though the league's become an option.
Yeah, and it will be good if those players that participated in it go high up in the draft, which will be very good for the sport. Hey, Chris, just in terms of our competition here in Australia, obviously, you know, America is number one. Where do we sit? Where would we rank?
It's a tricky one to say. We'd be up there. You know, like you say, the NBA is number one. A lot of the European leagues are walk-up beat up leagues, and they pay their imports a lot more money. Imports overseas are making $1-2 million a year. We're not near that yet. So the quality of imports we get, while they're fantastic, still don't compare to those in Europe. But I think our national talent is fantastic. We don't have a lot of teams, so it's not as widely spread out. But the style of play here in Australia, I think, is a lot of fun. It's full court. It's 94 feet of defense, and it's quick and athletic. So the European ones, they walk it up at a slower tempo, and they're allowed to beat each other up on defense a little bit more. So hard to compare, but I would certainly say that outside of the European, the Euro leagues, where all of the best teams in the country is coming, if we just compare domestic leagues, we'd have to be top five, top ten.
It's amazing watching the Last Dance and just the impact it's had on the wider sporting fan base. And I know people who were just going on YouTube watching Chicago Bulls games, and they didn't even really were basketball fans, such as is the the popularity of MJ and the Bulls of that era. Chris, just wanted to ask you, your defining memory of playing against them. You played against them in what, March 1998, and you were down by 17 points. It must have been something you'll be able to talk about for, 50, 60 years?
Well, we're 25 years later and we're talking about it on radio. It's fantastic. We got a win. I was only going to have one chance to play the Bulls, and it turned up and it was like the Beatles had rolled into Dallas. The streets were lined. It was crazy. Every emotion in the book, from nervousness to absolutely packing myself to just being in awe of looking down the other end of the court in the warm-ups, and there's Michael Jordan sort of come to life. I'd only ever seen him on the billboards and in the ads. So, probably I'll never forget lining up for a free throw, and I stupidly looked around, and there's Scottie Pippen, there's Steve Kerr, there's Michael Jackson. Michael Jordan, there's Phil Jackson. And just feeling completely out of my depth, and shot two of the worst free throws I've shot in my life before I sort of gave myself that little virtual punch in the face. Wake up, and you're making a fool out of yourself. And my teammates are incredible. We found a way to come back. Sent the game to overtime, and I got to play in overtime. And, it was one of those blocks of time where for 3.5 minutes I made a couple of shots. I had a couple of rebounds, and it was good as I could have been, and my teammates are incredible, and we ended up beating the Chicago Bulls. So not very often, or not many teams were able to do that, and certainly the win meant a lot more for our ball club than the loss did for the Bulls. But as you just said, here we are speaking about it 20 years later, and I know my kids have seen the tape because I make them watch it.
Oh, it's just like Laurie Daly.
Oh, yeah. I've got a couple of copies.
I'll tell you what else I found fascinating, Chris, was Scottie Pippen. Some of the things that he did, and in particular that game where they benched him when he wasn't allowed to take... Well, no, he benched himself, sorry, when he wasn't allowed to take that shot at the end of the game. Did that sort of surprise you, and did that go on a lot with basketball players? They just sort of, when things aren't going well and all of a sudden the coach says, no, you're not taking that shot, this bloke is, and... he just went and sat out. I couldn't believe that for someone
that has a great stature in the game. In the day, but to be reminded that you do remember there are a lot of egos, and there are a lot of young men being paid a lot of money, and their perceived pecking order is really important to them. Incorrectly, in my mind, I think the Australian sporting culture of requiring everyone is very different, but probably the part for me that even more so than that was when they asked him, to reflect back years ago of doing it. He said he'd do it again, which was really surprising that even in that context, he still stood by it. I think it's okay to say you made a mistake, and if you could have your time back, that's one you're not proud of. And the fact that he said he would have done it again surprised me. So, that was in the years that Jordan wasn't there. And ironically, the play that was drawn up, it was funny. I went back and rewound it and put my coach's hat on for a bit, but how'd they get the shot? It was brilliant. It was putting Tony Kukoc on his left hand with a lob onto the empty side of the court on the weak side, and he just quick turnaround at the free throw line and beat the New York Knicks. It was fantastically drawn up and executed. And, you know, the play was still for Scotty to make that pass, but he wanted to be the guy to shoot it. So it worked out well for the Bulls on that night. And probably the big story, I had a little bit, not the big story, that was it, but Bill Cartwright, who ended up being one of the assistant coaches when I was there, you saw how upset he was by it as a player, and by all reports went in the locker room in tears and just talked about the team falling apart if you're going to be like that, sort of brought everyone together. And there's been a fair bit written about his leadership and the leadership of some of the other guys around the Chicago Bulls. It isn't as well documented, but Bill Cartwright, you know, was a superstar last year. You know, Steve Kerr would have been, and we haven't seen much of that, but we've learned that in his coaching career. But then, yeah, that whole team was just full of champions.
Yeah, it's been fascinating viewing, to say the least. Hey, Chris, been really great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.